introduction and the opportunity to be back in Nebraska to talk with you about some areas that I think we have common interest. I'm going to take a little bit of liberty with my title. I'm not going to spend as much time on the international component as that might imply, and I didn't in the paper that you have in your proceedings. I want to talk a little bit about some macro developments, three or four of them that I think is going to be major and be important in determining your chances for profits and your success and viability in the years out in front of you, especially between, say, now and 2010. I get carried away sometime and don't remember to make some very basic points that I want to make. So usually I'll make myself a little list and I'll say, if I cover it all up, don't miss these points before I get more formal into my presentation. The price outlook for your CADs is going to be very good across the next several years. Maybe as many as 5 to 7 years. We are seeing an unusual market right now because of the Canadian border closing. Almost all of the very high and record high prices we've seen in cattle at virtually every level of the supply chain is due to the Canadian border closing. Presumably that's going to get resolved sometime in the months ahead of us, and we'll go back to a more normal scenario. But don't miss my point. That more normal scenario, for some reasons that I'll talk to you about, is going to have very good calf prices, barring some totally unexpected phenomenon across the next several years. A second point I don't want you to miss is that demand is increasing again after a 20-year slide, and that without any doubt in my mind, demand for beef is the most important determinant of your long-term success, viability, and chances to make a profit. A third point is that you really need to remember is that the only dollars that you share with the other players along the supply chain are the consumer's dollars. When you look at a concentrated market and being asked to make some changes that maybe you would rather not make, and I'll talk a little bit about those today, always run that suggestion that's coming to you through this filter. Does it get us closer to really doing a better job of serving the consumer? Because that's the only way we can add dollars. That's the only way we can enlarge the size of that economic pie. So run it through that filter always. Whatever else happens, however else we operate, we have to be consumer-driven and even more consumer-driven in the future than we've been in the past. And the fourth general point is that world trade accords and efforts by Congress to legislate solutions to economic problems is going to have an impact on your business in the future, and that always, always in the world trade accord negotiations and in congressional efforts to intervene in the marketplace and legislate solutions to what they perceive to be economic problems, there are unanticipated consequences and implications that will occur, and sometimes they could be very negative to you. So we need to kind of keep that point in mind as well. So, recognizing that we're going to talk a little bit about some macro influences in the beef business, I already suggested that I look beyond the temporary short-term situation related to the Canadian border, and we're going to focus on some major trends. Probably that demand is growing again should go up into the second spot, but I'll just let you look at those. We are very close to building, going back into our herd building part of the traditional cattle cycle. I suspect it'll occur in 2004, but it's imminent. Demand is growing again. We are seeing and will continue to see, in my impression, continued moves away from the price-driven system. Some of you don't like that. That trade in general in the world market, if you look at all possible ramifications and implications, tends to be net positive for the industry. That doesn't always mean that it's seen as net positive down on your particular ranch or your particular farm, depending on where you're located, but I think it is. But you need to be very careful with market interventions. And then we will look at some longer-term strategic moves that I think you need to be thinking about to get yourself positioned to be as successful and as profitable and as good a shape as you can be across the next several years. We are back in a supply mode. Not having hay and dry pastures and lots of things has delayed it, and it's awfully hard to think about holding a heifer to put in the breeding herd this year when she'll bring $700-$800 as a yearling. I'd sell her. And I think you have sold her. And I don't think we see any signs yet that we are in midst of a herd building phase and a holdback of heifer phase. But I do think it will occur, and I think it'll probably start during 2004. The January 1, 2004 inventory numbers are probably going to show a small decrease again compared to January 1, 2003. So technically, we'll still be in a herd liquidating phase for about the eighth consecutive year. We've never done that before. But when we turn this thing, we'll probably build the herd for 5 to 6 to 7 years, and that tends to boost prices and particularly make your calf prices look better. This is just a graph of the long-term cattle inventory. You can't hardly see the numbers there, and I didn't put it up with intent that you could, but if you look at where it ends on the right-hand side, we're about back to those lowest levels we got to in the 1980s. When you look up at that peak, which occurred in 1975, we went 20 years after the late 1970s with demand decreasing each year. I'll show you that later. And what decreases in demand does is runs producers out of business. We went from a much, much larger inventory number, up around 132 million head, all the way down into the 90-some million head. The beef cow herd went from about 47 million all the way down to 33 million. So those things are going to start to change, but we've got to go through that herd building phase again to get there. One thing you'll for sure see as we deal with this and start to turn that number back up across the next year or two, you will see reductions in per capita consumption of beef. That means we've got less beef on a per capita basis available, because that's what consumption is. It's a supply side measure, not a demand measure. Don't let anybody come into your meetings and say that that's a problem. We've got to take the heifer off the truck and out of the feed yard and get into the herd in order to build the inventory back up so we can be a bigger industry longer term. And an inevitable consequence of doing that will be reduced market share for beef, reduced per capita consumption of beef. USDA is projecting for 2004 62.4 pounds. That's about 5 pounds below this year, and it'll go lower in 2005 and in 2006. It's a negative in a way, but it's something we've got to go through to get the herd built back to where we would like to see it longer term. Here's my advice, and most of these little boxed items like this are in your written materials. I would be in the business relating to this supply-side phenomenon of trying to get out of the commodity beef business. Expand your herds if you have the resources. Look for bred heifers and cow-calf pairs, maybe to generate cash flow quicker. Improve the genetics in the process. Check out the price grids and the vertical line screening programs, and try to move the quality and size of your cattle toward what it appears the modern and changing consumer marketplace is going to want. You may have to make some changes here you don't want to make. You may have to change genetics. You may have to do some things that you haven't done historically. But run that through that filter again. If it's helping you be part of a changed industry that's doing a better job of serving the consumer, that's where you need to go. If we turn and look at the demand side of the price equation, we finally saw a 20-year slide end in about 1998. As an industry, we allow beef to diverge from what the modern consumer wants in terms of performance and consistent quality and convenience. And we still have 20 to 25% of the fresh beef and our select and choice grades going in the marketplace today that's too tough to chew. That's a hideously high product failure rate. And if you think about it, step back and think about it in the context of any other product or service that you know of and deal with, it makes us wonder sometime, and I'll show you in just a moment, that the cumulative decline in beef demand was about 50%. Makes me wonder sometime why it wasn't even worse. You're a Chevrolet pickup person. Would you keep going back to the Chevrolets if 25% of the new ones wouldn't start?
How about your tractors? How about your blue blazers? Would you go back to the men's shop if 25% of them didn't have holes in for the butts? I'm just being extreme there, trying to get you to stop and think about the magnitude of the problem that we've gone through. If it's too tough to chew, it's damn hard to enjoy. We've got to fix that. We're starting to fix that. But we're starting to fix that, and I'm upstaging myself a little bit, in an industry that's organized around some non-price coordination mechanisms like contracts and alliances and things like that. And those are controversial. But I think we have to do something to get the quality assurance back in the product at a high level. We're making some progress. That's why I think demand has turned around. And if we can keep building this thing, we can do some good for the industry, and we can do some good for you. This is a very busy graph, and I'll show you later where you can find this demand index on a website. There's reference to this in the written materials as well. But what I did is I pulled a little quadrant of this one out, and I think you can see this a little better. Got your third and fourth quarter performance since 1995 up through 2003. Now, let me share with you a little bit about how this thing works. If you look at that column on the quarter three that says 1998 equals 100, I did this demand index with 1980 as 100. We started it as a base year and tried to see how bad the problems were. By the time we got to 1998, the index that was 100 in 1980 was down to a little over 50. That's almost a 50% cumulative decline in the demand for beef. And demand for beef decreased every year from 1979 through 1998. So on this third quarter number here, you can see in 2000 it was about 55. This is a quarter number, not the yearly number. I've got yearly indices up on the website. But I rescaled this to show 1998 is 100. And you can read that 116.492, and we don't need all those decimals. You can read that as a 16.492% increase in demand since 1980 in the third quarter of this year. Anytime you go to the quarterly index and see the numbers in italics, this means that they're somewhat preliminary, and we still may see some changes in the per capita consumption for the quarter and the price for the quarter. And when we get all of those changes in, we'll take the italics off. I can tell you that even though I didn't have it at the time I wrote this, we now have the final number for that, and it's 115.8. Not quite as good as the 116.4 you see here. Don't you think about that? Cattle Facts estimated that the demand increase in 99 and 2000 and 2001 each year added $30 to $40 to $50 to the value of a slaughter steer. What this index showed is that we had a dip in 2002 based on the BSE problems in Japan, and they're such a big customer, they're that important. And then it started to surge and increase again in 2003. If we can keep that going, that demand side pull is just going to yank you into a bigger industry ultimately, and a more profitable industry, and a much better shot down at your level of making a buck in the cattle business. So as you think about what you can do in addition to good management of your program, think about what you can do at the local, state, and national levels to try to keep us involved in programs and in circumstances that give us a chance to grow that demand side of this price equation. It's just that important. And here's my statement that just kind of drives that point home with you. In the short term, from year to year, within the year, depending on the weights of the cattle, depending on some other things, the big thing that moves price around is changes in supply. But in the long term, the big thing that makes for a viable industry is where our demand is. You've got to have a product that the consumer wants as they get more income, and they'll pay you for convenience, and we're finally getting some convenience into our products and getting some offerings out there. It's those sorts of new product lines that I think are very important to us. 15 years ago, The beef industry was running about 30 or 40 new products a year. The chicken people were doing about 150. We've had something like 400 to 500 new products offered within the past 3 years. And that's not all coming from the checkoff program. I mean, that's a catalyst and that's helping. But that's coming from money being spent by the big packers who finally started to get out of the business of being low-cost commodity operators and get into the product business. And they're offering some branded product lines. And if they're going to offer a branded product line, they've got to have some coordination, some quality control, and they've got to feel comfortable standing behind the product. And we're finally starting to see that happen. So I can't overemphasize the importance of demand to you here in terms of determining your long-term well-being. The trade thing is there. It's going to be a continuing important factor that will impact the beef industry in the presence of accords like NAFTA, GATT, and the new WTO trade negotiations and trade accords. Most of you know the story here. We export a lot of beef and veal, roughly 9%, a number that is roughly 9% of what our production is. We are also major importers of beef. Roughly 11% of the weight that we produce. If you look at dollars worth here, our exports are worth a lot more money than the imports. My research basically shows that in net, the industry benefits from this. We are shipping high-quality beef and high-priced beef into a world market with Japan, South Korea, Mexico and Canada buying about 90% of our product. And we're importing processing beef primarily from Australia, Argentina, New Zealand. That works for me because when I model this and try to analyze this, and it's not easy because the data aren't very good, I come out with net benefits and a larger industry than we would have if we didn't have trade, and I'm trying to account for both the exports and the imports. Higher prices than we would have if we didn't have trade, and a more viable industry for you. There's reference in the paper in the proceedings to a piece of work that you can find if you want to go check that out in a little bit more detail. I know this is controversial. I understand that. What I'm telling you is that we've seen that recently when we decided that we were going to tell mainland China that we didn't want to see quite as many imports of textile products coming in here. Well, the day we announced that, the Chinese officials canceled the trip that they had planned to come over to the U.S. to buy more of our grain and oil seeds. We've got the same thing rattling around with regard to steel. You can't close your borders to imports and feel like you're protecting anything, in my assessment, because it typically triggers reciprocal action and closes the doors to those other countries that are going to buy your product as an export. So in net, I find benefits here, and that kind of fits because we're exporting high-value, high-priced product, and we're importing lower-value, lower-priced processing beef. This is controversial. I don't want to turn this into a debate of your favorite issue, whether it be cool or pack a ban or whatever, and I'll not do that. My role is to try to keep in front of producers around the country some thinking and some research and some good science that says there's always more than one side to this thing. The tendency toward market interventions by Congress may be the most important determinant of the future of your beef business. I really think it's that important. The tendency toward market intervention may be the most important thing determining where your industry is going to go. The net impact on producers of some of these market interventions is anything but clear. When you dig hard and find the unexpected implications, which most other discussions ignore. One of the things that gives me heartburn about legislation that would come in, intervene in the marketplace, and say to you and the people you're selling to how you can and cannot sell your cattle or how the packers can and cannot buy the cattle, one of the things that really worries me is that across the past 5 to 8 years, the three big packers, and I don't know the number, but they've spent billions of dollars in new product development. I just have a feeling that if I were in their position, and I encourage you to think about it this way, and somebody tells them that you can't specify in a contract or some other non-price means of coordination here what cattle you need or hogs you need to support this branded new product initiative over here, I think I'd quit working on
developing and spending money on the new product initiatives. And I don't think very many people who support this type of intervention have stopped and thought about that. Eight of us from seven land-grant universities, including University of Nebraska, put out a little statement last year about this and basically tried to lay out some of those things that might not be thought about as the debate and the dialogue goes on here. I also refer that to the website. We see our job is trying to put information in front of you so you can make a better decision. I have a somewhat controversial colleague at Virginia Tech who's written some over time about how we perform in academia, whether it's as in research or in our extension and outreach mode. And he makes a point that's very valid, I think. He says it's always easier for us to tell you what you want to hear than to tell you what you need to know. And that's true. And one of the jobs that I think some of us who really have concerns about our meats industry in this country, and our primary concern is folks like those of you in the room, one of the things we are obliged to do, if it looks like there's something out there that you don't want to hear, but you need to know it, we need to say it. And that's what we've tried to do in some of these pieces that we've put out. I coordinated, and I didn't write them myself, but I coordinated two papers on COOL, two papers on mandatory price reporting, and two papers on pack-a-ban, and they're up on the homepage of the website that I'll refer you to later. You might just want to go take a look at those, and hopefully we've done some good in terms of contributing to the base of information here. This one worries me. It's not the topic that I find most favorable with you if I come and introduce it, but it may be the most important one that I introduce. And there's a statement that they just can cut both ways. Programs that add cost without adding price and value at the producer level will lower your prices. There's no doubt about that. The pack and the processor and the value-added further processor and the retailer in the margin business. If that costs go up, they're going to extract a bigger margin. We don't like that, but that's the way the world operates. They're not price takers the way you are. And if they take a bigger margin and nothing happens to improve the price up to consumer level, your price has got to go down. NPR, mandatory price reporting, COOL may fall in this category. I've both sides of those. I'm not convinced either way yet. So just try to present good, solid, objective information there. It appears that mandatory price reporting probably added some cost in the middle of the system, but may not have given us access to appreciably better price information. There'd probably be different opinions on that in the room, but that's what I'm seeing when I look at the surveys. The pack-a-ban legislation, I've already referred to this, could have the unintended result of reducing the huge sums that larger packers have spent on new products across the past 10 years, especially the past 5 to 8 years, and make no mistake about it. You don't have the money to spend on new product development, and your checkout program is not big enough, with all due respect to what it accomplishes, to get this thing turned around. You had to have them getting out of the business of being low-cost commodity operators and into the product business to turn this demand picture around. And their new efforts in the domestic and international markets have done that. And the data kind of speak for themselves there. So it's an important issue, and there's no clear-cut answers, and there's no one answer. So you need to be very careful, just to reiterate this point, on these interventions. You need those investments in new product forms from the large packers, and we've already talked about that. And the point, I think, is made, and so let's talk in closing about some little strategic planning approaches. Be consumer-driven. Average pricing is bad. Obsolete grades will not allow price-driven systems to bring coordination and quality control, so we're moving away from the price-driven systems. We should have gotten tenderness scores in the choice and select back then good grades in beef 20 years ago. We have a massive policy failure here. USDA will not change grades unless the industry comes bangs on the door with a consensus attitude and says, we need the grades changed. We've got the southern half of the feeding zone basically feeding cattle and getting $2 or $3 a hundredweight more than they're worth. And we've got you folks up here feeding cattle and getting $2 or $3 a hundredweight less than they're worth. Some of my colleagues at Kansas State tried to estimate the income transfer here, and they put it at about $30 million a year.
Now, you really think out of that environment we're going to get a consensus that we need to put tenderness scores in the quality grades? No way. No consensus coming from the industry. USDA backs off and is not willing to be progressive here, and that's their policy position. They don't change grades unless the industry wants them changed. And then they'll administer a change. So we've drifted and we've drifted and we've drifted. We've had no way for the system to send that price signal down to you when you had high-quality cattle that were worth more. We just didn't have the necessary conditions because we didn't have the grades we needed. And we drifted. Now, we went away from the price-driven system, the contracts, and the producer-initiated alliances, and we start getting some coordination and some quality controls. So that's the big change that I see in the industry. You need to look for ways to get individual animal valuations and prices if you possibly can. Take advantage of opportunities. Contracts and price grids, if they help. This is some of the changes you may have to look at that you may prefer you not have to fool with. I understand that. Vertical alliances, if they fit the program, most of these alliances have been started by producers. Know what the modern marketplace wants. If you want to be an independent producer and continue to stay outside of the contract mode and continue to stay outside of the alliances, then you've got to take a look at what the modern marketplace needs and try to offer it. I put this next slide in as an interesting point. I hear it more in hogs, but it could be said in your cattle as well. It goes like this. A conversation I've had with independent hog producers. They don't want my hogs. And I ask, are they uniform and consistent? And they reply, they're like peas in a pod and very uniform. And I ask, what if they're uniformly wrong? And in the paper, we've got a little typo there where it said, should have said, there's a long silence that prevails here. It says it's a long sentence that comes here. Change that. Change that. Think about that. In a way, if my hogs or my cattle are uniformly wrong vis-a-vis the box that has been developed in Excel's quality control program or Tyson's program or anybody else's program, that set of cattle may be worth less to them and less valuable to them than just a random set of cattle that have a few in the pen that would work. I know where this is coming from. Smithfield Foods is in my state. They do 70% of their hog kill from the same set of genetics that has some color in it. It has some moisture in it. It has some portion size very important in it. If they have somebody come along with a whole different set of genetics than hogs that doesn't fit their quality assured program, they almost have to go over here and develop a new marketing program to get rid of them. It just doesn't fit. And I've had this happen to me two or three times where the producer would stand and look at me and obviously had never thought about that. What if they're uniformly wrong? Don't let yourself get caught in having cattle that are uniformly wrong vis-a-vis what the modern consumer-driven marketplace is starting to want. So before I put up a overhead here that shows some of my contacts, we're going to have a few minutes. We might take a question or two. I'll wait and see. And contacts and some of these references are in the paper you have as well. I just share this observation with you. I think you need to really have an open mind across the next several years. The price system is failing us because of problems with grades and increased sophistication in the industry. If I had my druthers, we would have a price-driven system. We wouldn't have all these contracts. We wouldn't have all these formula binding agreements. We would have had a price-driven system with a set of grades that allowed the price signaling system to work. But we don't have that. And we didn't get the quality control and the coordination that prompted these big packers to make big-time investments in new products until they went to some non-price means of quality control. Think about that. I wish we'd spent some of our time and energy in the past decade or two trying to make sure we got the grades changed. This is not a new issue with me. I went to Wisconsin in the mid-80s and spoke to a national group of meat scientists up there who make their career working with quality grades in beef. And I said to them, you better be thinking about what you can do when the grades are gone. And they, you know, you could have heard a pin drop in there. They had no clue what I was talking about. I got to tell you, 20 years ago, if I'd been standing here, I would tell you that the grades, if they were not improved, would not last another 5 years. They lasted. Bill Hellman was calling in about 1995 and 96 to abandon them because he argued that we would be better off without them. I don't know whether he was right or not, but we've still got the same outdated, obsolete, outmoded, ineffective set of grades we had in the 1970s. To be part of a new car that should line, you may have to be part of an alliance or see if you can find a price grid that works for you. To succeed, the industry must find a way to succeed. And that means for you to succeed, for you to have a better chance of making a profit, you simply have to find a better way to better serve the consumer and get some of those rewards back down to you. If we can't do it with a price-driven system, it looks like we're going to do it with contracts and other non-price approaches unless we pass a law and said we can't use them. And that's kind of an interesting issue that probably needs more discussion. My contact stuff here, that RILP website is mentioned two or three times in the paper. That's where you can find some of these things on the cool and that sort of thing. At the bottom is a weekly letter that I do, weekly market advisory letter that I do if you're interested in getting access to that and seeing what I'm telling you that I think you ought to be doing about your feeder cattle or your fat cattle, etc. Okay? I'm done. Program, you want questions or later?